Welcome to episode number 3 of Living Rent-Free in My Head. And today you are definitely going to be living rent-free in my head because there are some things that I want to talk about. I've been living in the past these days. You know, they say never to live in the past. But, you know, I think that is true for people that, you know, didn't have that great of a past. You know, but my childhood was pretty sick. Mostly because I had a great set of parents. You know, my parents did everything for me. You know, they were two of the biggest proponents of me making a YouTube channel. And before even that venture happened, you know, they were big, big Treib fans. When I qualified for state for wrestling for the first time, they both slept in their car to watch me go to and out. You know, at the state wrestling tournament my junior year, all the hotel reservations were booked up. And, you know, old Treib wasn't expected to make it to the state tournament, but I proved all the haters wrong and made it and, you know, didn't make an impact. You know, I went 2-0. I lost both my matches. But the next year, my claim to fame in wrestling was I was one match away from placing at state. You win some, you lose some. But no, my parents have always been, you know, big supporters of mine, and that's a great example of how they have been very supportive of me. But, you know, this privileged background or, you know, this upbringing that I have, you know, makes it hard for me to come up with excuses. When I was a kid, I would try to come up with every excuse in the book, you know, to try and be lazy, despite the fact that I had all the support in the world. But, you know, that didn't matter to me because I wanted to play all the video game systems that they got me for Christmas. So, you know, that backfired a little bit on them for sure. They did buy us a different game system, I think, you know, pretty much every year for Christmas. You know, all the handheld game systems, all the consoles, you know, we got all of those. But, you know, I think they started to regret it once they kind of figured out that we were going to be subpar learners, my brother and I. And, you know, it is kind of funny to watch your parents kind of slowly give up on you academically. You know, I think that coming out of elementary school, there was some hope, and, you know, it was probably like a 5% hope that, you know, maybe Treib can turn it around and, you know, be an average academic student. But, you know, once seventh grade kind of came, I think my parents were like, just try and graduate. I think my parents cashed out my college fund around seventh grade because it was here where I failed homeroom. My parents came into a parent-teacher conference, and I remember my mom sat down, and the teacher who was my homeroom teacher was also my science teacher. And I was failing that class too, but I think really the headline event was that I was failing advisory is what they called it, but, you know, homeroom for, you know, lack of a better term. And she said it was because I didn't turn in any crosswords or word searches. And, you know, it was a homeroom class, and there's 20 minutes in that class, and some of these brainiacs would finish this in like 20 minutes. And it's like, you know, I don't know a five-letter word for, you know, a bad weather situation. You know, I'm still thinking about it, and we can't pull our phones out because, you know, this lady, this teacher has a very aggressive, you know, no phone policy. So, you know, I wasn't acing these crosswords, and I wasn't, you know, finding these words quick enough. You know, I liked the crosswords in elementary school when it was just, you know, up and down and side to side. As soon as they threw in diagonals at me, you know, that's when I tapped out of word searches. You know, don't put words diagonally. That's not the way God intended. God intended you to read up and down and left and right. You know, diagonal is just crazy. But anyway, my mom comes in, she hears this, and she's not even really mad at me for not doing the word searches. In the crosswords, she was mad because she knows that I know how much she loves doing crosswords and word searches. And she was like, why didn't you just bring these home for me to do and I would have done them? And, you know, it was that lack of critical thinking skills that I think, you know, have still harmed me to this day. You know, my mom is an awesome lady and is somebody that will, you know, help me out at every turn. But, you know, instead, I had it crinkled up in my backpack. Along with other miscellaneous papers. You know, I was one of those kids that didn't have things organized by folders. You know, Renee is a perfect example of that. She still has some folders to this day, you know, broken down basically like for work based on like department and hour of day that she needs to get things done. Not me. You know, I'm a scatterbrained motherfucker. Like, I have things scattered all over the place, not really neatly put away, and was like that in middle school as well. And, you know, they say that that kind of damages you academically, and, you know, it's not going to be good for you down the road because it's going to harm your organizational skills and, you know, it's going to hurt you and things like that. And they're right. I'm not very organized, and I never have been, and I still can't find diagonal words in word searches. I was really on a line in seventh grade. You know, I don't think I was at, like, you know, repeat the seventh grade level, but I was definitely on a summer school level. You know, I just missed out on summer school like every year. And it was really a race to the finish with me and my mom. It was really just a race for me and her to both get me out of summer school. And yeah, we did it. You know, I say we, she ended up doing the crosswords and the word searches, and I turned them in. So shouts out to my mom for being really good at finding words and word searches. And, you know, those diagonal words are definitely no joke. I remember in a geometry class when we had to write down shapes and stuff, and I was already really bad at geometry. And a lot of it for geometry for me had to do with me and my inability to draw shapes, I think. You know, they'd say, you know, draw this shape, draw this triangle, get the measurements, tell me what kind of triangle it is. The fact that I, you know, my triangles would have five sides to them, and, you know, they'd say draw an isosceles triangle, and I'm like, man, you're getting a cone and that's as good as you're gonna get. Like, my art skills really hindered my geometry. And on top of that, I didn't really do my vocab either. So, you know, really just English and art really hindered my ability to do math. At one point, I had a 19% in geometry. There was no saving me. You know, I was going to have to redo geometry. And, you know, I was doing it as a sophomore and a junior. You know, I was the oldest motherfucker in that class, you know, by far. You know, and that sucks. But, you know, eventually I did pass, and, you know, I learned how to draw an acute, an obtuse, and an isosceles triangle. I was kind of oblivious to my academic failures. You know, I think a lot of it was because I was still playing sports. And, you know, I think every high school athlete who I think was in my boat, where you really liked playing sports, and you played a little bit, but you didn't play a whole lot. You know, I think you overestimated your skills or whatever. And, you know, I thought maybe there'd be like a D3 NAIA college that would want my services on the gridiron or perhaps on the wrestling mat. But, you know, I didn't get to thinking, you know, why would just like any random NAIA school want me or know about me? You know, a guy who is just fighting for time at right tackle on the JV team as a sophomore, who also failed biology, geometry, and can't even find diagonal words in a word search. You know, these are things that are holding me back in the realm of becoming a college student athlete. And, you know, I was oblivious to that. And, you know, props to my parents for when I first brought this up, for not laughing right in my face. But I do remember it was a conversation at the end of sophomore year when I went up to them and I was just kind of like, you know, what are my options? You know, where am I going to go to college? And then my dad's like, well, you're going to have to pay for it. And I was like, well, what if, hear me out, I get a scholarship. And my dad said, you don't even bench 165 pounds and you're fighting for time on the JV team. I will let you think about that. And I did think about it, and he was right. So my academic struggles really peaked in middle and high school, but there were signs that I wasn't going to be, you know, an academic machine as early as elementary school. I got pulled out of class to go to a thing called penmanship intermission, which is just an absolutely wild thing to call a event for kids with bad handwriting in elementary school. I would tell my mom I was going to ship mission, which made sense to her because she was a special ed teacher and the kids in her class would just play Battleship all day. So she just assumed that I was going to a special ed class and playing Battleship all day. And, you know, by the looks of me, you know, that made sense to her. And I can't, you know, disagree with that. So, you know, I guess that added up. But that wasn't what I was doing. You know, I was getting a workshop in how to correct my penmanship, which was absolutely terrible. You know, when I was a kid, you put a pencil in my hand and I held it like a caveman. I remember specifically one thing that I really struggled to do was write capital N's. A lady that, you know, was teaching me how to, you know, better my penmanship. I kind of ruined her life. I remember I would write these N's backwards and she got so mad at me one point that she made me call my mom. And it was only there that she learned that it was penmanship intermission and not ship mission. And she figured out that I wasn't just playing Battleship all day. I was just getting schooled on how bad my handwriting is. And she knew that, too. She knew how bad my penmanship is. And, you know, to this day, you know, when I write an N, I make sure, you know, that I write it the right way. I am a pro at writing N's now. That is something that is in my repertoire, you know, not as much as looking for diagonal words and word searches. But if you need me to write a capital N, I got you. When I would come back from these handwriting boot camps, you know, on Fridays, there would be these other groups of kids, the special subsection group that would get to leave class at the end of the day. And they were called the Banana Splits group. And, you know, I was no academic genius, you know, like we have already established in this video. But what I do know is that penmanship intermission is a lot more intimidating of a name than Banana Splits. And I knew that that was a group that I would definitely prefer to be with. And, you know, if anything, Banana Splits sounds more like a special ed group than penmanship intermission, you know. So I was a little confused by that. And, you know, I knew it wasn't, you know, a special ed group because, you know, my homies in the penmanship intermission group were not all going to it, but it was a majority of the class. And, you know, a lot of the kids in the special reading group, you know, that were advanced readers and, you know, the future of this great generation were also going to this group. And it left me and literally like only four other kids in this classroom. At the end of the week, you know, you'd see the same four kids all throughout elementary school, and then, you know, you just wonder why these other kids, you know, get to get banana splits at the end of the day at the counselor's office. But, you know, nobody asked me why I had to go aside and, you know, write the alphabet a million times, despite the fact that, you know, I learned the alphabet probably in kindergarten or so. But, you know, I showed the same respect that they showed me when I was taking a penmanship, you know, workshop. So, you know, I never asked. Around junior year, I got to figure out what the Banana Splits group was. It was for children who come from parents of divorce. And, you know, that is hilarious, actually. That is a really funny name for a real serious issue. You know, I don't know why they get to have, you know, such a silly, fun name. But, you know, mine gets to be really serious. You know, I get penmanship intermission and they get banana splits. You know, I think mine is probably only going to be understood by the teachers and the advanced readers in the class. But, you know, still not very fair to get called out every day when I have to go to this. And, you know, these kids, you know, they have a mom who's banging the neighbor or they have a dad who, you know, works too much and had to leave and they get to be banana splits. You know, I don't think that's very fair. So, you know what I did? I decided to jot down a couple of names that would be better for banana splits to make me feel like, you know, we're on the same spectrum here as a penmanship intermission. So I have Divorce Desserts, which is exactly what it is, and I think is the best name possible. Daddy's Moving Out Midday Treat, you know, a specialty. Mom's Banging the Neighbor Nice Little Treat. You know, we already discussed what Mom's doing, so we already know. Everyone except the kids with loving parents get banana splits. You know, really to the point there, and really kind of how I felt, like it's my fault that my parents love each other and I don't get this dessert. Like, just absolutely ludicrous. If you can write your ends the right way, come get your dessert, and if your parents are also divorced. I almost got the rights to that one, but unfortunately, my parents are still together, so still no banana splits for me. This stuff really wasn't that long ago. You know, I graduated high school in 2017, which, you know, is 8 years ago, which still, you know, it seems like a long time ago. But in all reality, you know, I'm 26. I'm not that old. And, you know, I want to believe that. But every time that I go on Instagram, you know, and I scroll through some reels, you know, I get one, you know, every couple weeks or so that says you've officially reached unk status. And it's like SmackDown versus Raw 2007, Jeff Hardy jumping off, you know, the Raw set, and like Adrian Peterson highlights. Now that we got all that fun childhood stuff out of the way, let's hit on a couple of talking points. Mainly today, I want to talk about the Jacksonville Jaguars and James Gladstone, who is the new general manager of the Jags. Mr. Gladstone was most recently the director of scouting strategy for the Rams in 2019. He's been there since 2016. Mr. Gladstone is not that well known. He's young and inexperienced in this specific role. He's so much inexperienced that he didn't even have a Wikipedia page when he was first hired. You know, when you look up James Gladstone, this is the first thing that pops up. And, you know, this guy is considered to be the honorable James Gladstone. Now, I bet you he is. You know, he's a guy, a Canadian politician, you know, and I glanced at his Wikipedia page for all of like 2 minutes. And, you know, we've already established in this video that, you know, I'm not a big penmanship guy. I'm also not a big reader. So, you know, I'm sure if his name is, you know, if he's got the honorable in his name, you know, then he's a pretty stand-up honorable guy. But I do think if James Gladstone is somebody who brings a Super Bowl to Duval County, I think he would be the real honorable James Gladstone. Because you think about what's happened in Duval County is a whole lot of nothing. And, you know, I think, you know, if you think of people in Canada, you know, how many people are you going to name before you get to James Gladstone in Canada? You know, our James Gladstone here in Jacksonville, he could get a statue if he does really well. But, you know, I'm not as excited as a lot of people are, mostly because, you know, he is kind of inexperienced and he is young and we don't know a lot about him. I'm not going to start blindly believing in James Gladstone because I have blindly believed in a lot of people in the Jacksonville Jaguars organization that have blindly broken my heart. Trevor Lawrence has kind of probably been the most recent example. And, you know, I think there's a lot of hope in the Jacksonville building that the new front office, Gladstone and Liam Cohen alike, can bring the best out of Trevor Lawrence. But, you know, it's just a recent string that have been kind of similar to other Jags of the past. I mean, Doug Marrone, a guy who, you know, the players loved and I think was a guy that was a likable underdog as a coach. You know, I really liked him. He sucked. Blake Bortles sucked. You know, everybody that, you know, we were told was going to be good or everything that we thought was going to be great for the Jacksonville Jaguars never ends up being good. But it is a complete 180 from what was in the room before James Gladstone got there. You know, Trent Baalke, the fact that, you know, this guy who doesn't have a Wikipedia page and is, you know, really inexperienced, doesn't have anything really as far as accolades or accomplishments, you know, just word of mouth from other, you know, NFL people and NFL executives, you know, that is better than Trent Baalke, who had been an NFL GM and, you know, had some, you know, hits in the draft, but, you know, most of them weren't great. That kind of just shows, you know, when NFL minds or NFL execs say a certain thing about a certain candidate, you know, they're usually right. You know, people that have been doing this for a long time and people whose job it is to evaluate talent, people that have been a GM for a long time, people that have been in the NFL world for a long time. They don't just say things to say things, typically in this world. So, you know, when Trent Baalke, who had been blackballed for a long time after his stint with the 49ers, when he was looked at as a bad hire, he was a bad hire. So, you know, it's good that Shad Khan, you know, maybe is looking at his mistakes and is going outside of traditionally what he would do as an owner as far as hiring James Gladstone, because it is a different type of hire. It's not a Shad Khan hire. But yeah, I think I can see why people are excited about it. I'm going to hold my water. You know, I'm not going to just jump to conclusions and say, you know, the Jags are back and everything is all grand. I will, you know, come to that conclusion. I will get hyped as soon as we win one game, you know, as soon as we go 1-0, or, you know, even if we start the season 0-3 and we go 1-3, you know, I will probably turn the ship around and say the Jags are 100% back, because that's just how I am. But I want to see the results on the field first, before I state anything on how good this hiring was, because we really don't know anything about him. You know, I don't see the point, because, you know, this could all still blow up in our faces. We don't know. But in the grand scheme of things, you know, who knows? I hope nothing but the best for my favorite team, your favorite team, and your mom's favorite team, the Jacksonville Jaguars. Of course, I always do. But, again, gonna hold my water. I do want to now touch on Kill Tony before we get out of here. I did miss out on a chance to talk about Kill Tony in the last episode. I did have it in my show notes, but I forgot to touch on it. So here we go. We're going to do kind of a little bit of a rapid fire here. Touch on Kill Tony, because there is a lot to talk about. And I already feel like I've gone kind of long in this episode. So, you know, we're going to try and keep it a little bit short. So first of all, I want to talk about day two of Madison Square Garden for Kill Tony and the boys. I think that day two was better than day one as far as the overall show goes and the bucket pulls and just, you know, pure entertainment value. I liked the panelists more. You know, I think that day one had more star power, but day two, you know, brought us Joe DeRosa and James McCann. You know, not as big of names in, you know, not only the world of comedy, but in the world of just pop culture. I think that those two absolutely murdered their spots when they were on Kill Tony, and murdered their spots in Madison Square Garden. I love to see James McCann getting opportunities. You know, we'll touch on his latest episode of Kill Tony here in a little bit. And, you know, he made the best out of a bad situation there. And in Madison Square Garden, I mean, he killed it as a host. And I think he's going to be a guy in the stand-up comedy world that if you don't know who he is, I mean, you are going to. He is a very, very funny guy. He has a one bit that's one of my favorites, where he goes over, you know, fool me once, you know, shame on you. And then, you know, he goes on from there. And it's really, really funny. And I suggest you check it out. It's a good, good bit. And I will say that, you know, Tony did this whole, you know, monologue before the show started, basically about how James and Joe were his second option, you know, not his first option to be the host of this show. And before, or no, after he, you know, announces them as the hosts of the show, you hear the Undertaker's legendary gong, and he comes out and has a little back and forth with Tony.
Wrap it up then, or else they bring out the angry... Wait a second. We shocked the world with this one.
60 seconds, right? That's all they get?
That's all they get. Or else I'm pretty sure you throw them back to where they came from.
I'm right here.
We love it.
First, when I heard that, I thought, oh my God, The Undertaker is going to be a panelist for this episode. But he was not. It was just going to be The Undertaker's gong going off instead of the angry West Hollywood Bear. And I think that was a complete missed opportunity. And it seemed like Tony and Undertaker were kind of having a fun little, you know, back and forth. And it seemed like The Undertaker might have been willing to be a panelist for this episode. And that would have been awesome. And I think Tony would have loved it. I wonder If there was a reason that The Undertaker couldn't be a panelist, or if he didn't want to, or you know what the situation was. But yeah, no, Undertaker would have been a great panelist for the New Year's Eve show. You know, I don't know if he saw Ric Flair's, you know, debacle, and he's like, I don't want to be like Rick. But, you know, yeah, it was awesome to see The Undertaker. And they completely underutilized him, because every time that they were about to bring him out, Tony was like, oh, no, I can't do it to, you know, a woman, or I can't do it to this other guy that has like a mental disability or whatever. You know, he didn't bring The Undertaker out for the rest of the night. You know, he's kept saving people from The Undertaker, and it's like, why, you know, say you're gonna have The Undertaker come out if he's not gonna come out for the rest of the show?
We're gonna save you from The Undertaker coming out here. Stop. We're not, the last, that would be just so depressing.
What the fuck are you wearing?
All right, no. I'm gonna save you again. Saving people tonight.
You know, I don't know. You know, maybe there's some more backstage stuff going on when it comes to the dead man on Kill Tony on New Year's Eve, but I wanted more Undertaker. I don't know about you guys, but I was a proponent of more dead man walking on the stage for Kill Tony on day two of the Madison Square Garden show. You know, going over one of the guest appearances on the show for the stand-up, Andrew Dice Clay, man. You know, I've never been an Andrew Dice Clay guy. I think I missed that boat. I think I missed that generation. But, you know, Tony sure hypes him up a lot. And I know that there are a lot of guys who are big fans of his. And he went out there and bombed in front of the Madison Square Garden crowd. I think he recited a famous bit of his. And the crowd, I just didn't know it, I guess, you know, and kind of ate shit out there. And it was a tough scene to watch, almost kind of like a funny bomb, though. It was kind of funny to watch, because I think at first he didn't really want to do this bit, but then he did it because I think he thought that more people were going to be behind him, but didn't end up working out like that, didn't work out in his favor. So poor Andrew Dice Clay. But yeah, it was tough to watch. You know, I actually skipped Cam Patterson's set during this episode, and that's the first time I did that. And it didn't, you know, I don't know if I missed anything. I haven't seen it clipped anywhere, so I guess it's not anything too groundbreaking. You know, we said on the last episode that we're not really feeling Cam Patterson lately. He's kind of been, you know, on a downhill slope for us, and you know, he didn't have a great set day one on Madison Square Garden, so I wasn't really too keen on watching his second set. He might have even said the same one. I wouldn't put it past Cam Patterson to do that. So, yeah, I wrote that down. I thought that was something of note that I would bring up. Another guy I want to talk about, one of the bucket pulls, Luke Stamm. He had a great set and really killed it. And, you know, we have a video talking about him. Yeah, I think first appeared on the show, or it was the second bucket pull, and I put him on a list of the best bucket pulls of the month when he was on the show, and he had another great set here on Madison Square Garden. He just ruined his shot, you know, of maybe coming back, because he just had a really bad interview where he talked about, like, you know, kicking dogs and shit. And then the following Monday's episode of Kill Tony was awesome, because the bucket pulls were on fire. You know, I think just the opening bucket pull was the only one who ended up flopping. Everybody else did very well. Peter Angelo also came back. He was a guy who performed during the Legion of Skanks episode. He's a openly gay man who looks like the biggest Trump supporter, right-leaning man you've ever seen in your entire life. He just does not look like a gay man, but he is. And, you know, he had a really good set. He came back to do one, and he performed really well. And the two guests, Adam Reyes, Tony Caruso, and Jim Norton, two fantastic panelists. Anytime Adam Ray debuts a new character, it's fun to watch. And Jim Norton, I think, is one of the more underrated panelists for Kill Tony. He's one of the best at giving advice to the bucket pulls. You know, and that's one of the things that I think makes for a great guest on Kill Tony, is somebody who offers up advice.
Hello, yeah. You're a little tentative. Next time you might want to come out just a little bit more
get to a punchline a little faster. That's all. It's a little quicker if you can.
Hassan Ahmad also got pulled out of the bucket, and he had a really good set as well. Wouldn't expect him to get pulled out of the bucket. He's a legitimate stand-up comedian, and he did a great job there. Probably the standout moment of the show was Jake Kennedy, who didn't have a great stand-up set, but he played the violin, and he killed it. At the very end of the night, Tony said, go hop on your little scooter, come back with your violin and play at the end of the show. And he did, and he killed it. And Tony offered him a spot on the band at a different date or a later date. And, you know, I'm excited to see him come back. And this is a cool opportunity. And, you know, one of the things that Tony does well on the show, you know, he gives people opportunities, regular people, talented people that, you know, are just coming on the show to do an open mic and, you know, get roasted by Tony Hinchcliffe. And, you know, you might just walk into an opportunity to show off your talents in other ways. You know, this guy came up, did stand-up comedy, brought the fact that he was a professional violin player and, you know, got to play. And now he's offered a spot on the band, or, you know, at least for one night or a couple of times. And, you know, that's how your career changes. That's how you get exposure. And it's a cool thing to see. And it's awesome that Tony does that. Frank the Mint was hilarious. He was a former doctor who came out, and he had a hilarious speech impediment, and they made fun of that, you know, a million times. He's a great, funny guy. Jack McWilliams was another good stand-up comedian that was on the show. He had a great bit about a safe phrase instead of a safe word. William Montgomery also came back in this episode, and it was great to see him back on our screens. And this latest episode of Kill Tony was hilarious because it was everything that other episode with Tony Caruso and Jim Norton wasn't. It was a bad, bad episode for Bucket Pulls. Tony didn't give out a single big joke book until the record for Bucket Pulls was broken. And, you know, the guy who ends up getting the big joke book at the end of the night is somebody who, again, doesn't really have that great of a set. And it was just, it was a hilariously bad episode. And I think my favorite part of this bad episode was when Tony, I think regretfully so, he did not want to do this, but he brought out Drew Nickens in the midst of all this bombing, you know, because his whole thing was, you know, when people bomb, we bring out Drew Nickens. And he brought out Drew Nickens. And I think after he did all these bombs, he's like, well, I got to do it. And when he did it, you know, oh my God, Drew came out and it was like, you know, he was one of the bad bucket pulls that just got pulled out. And, you know, it was a lightning round. They didn't even interview him. They just got him out of there and barely got any laughs, just like all the other bucket pulls that bombed. And it was hilarious, you know, very, very bad stuff. Won't be surprised, you know, if Drew never shows up again or if it's a long time before we see Mr. Nickens on the show. But, you know, again, I think I like these episodes that are, you know, really bad because I think it brings out a different side of Tony. Tony gets agitated and he has like these funny back and forths with Red Band. And, you know, James McCann is a good guest in these scenarios. And he actually had a bit where he was hosting and it was funny. And, you know, I think that every once in a while you got to have these really historically bad episodes of Kill Tony because, you know, when you have episodes like, you know, the one with Tony Caruso and Jim Norton, I think it gives, you know, some stand-up comedians like a false sense of security to say, you know, this is how easy it is. You know, anybody could kind of come up here and do stand-up comedy, but, you know, it really isn't that easy. And you saw that when Tony pulled out, you know, 20-something names out of the bucket this last Monday. So very, very different scene. On these Kill Tony episodes. But that is going to do it for me, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Living Rent Free in My Head. I really do appreciate you guys taking the time out of your day to listen to me ramble about things I'm interested in and just random thoughts that are going in or that are going on in my head. Thank you guys again for tuning in. Make sure to hit that subscribe button, click the bell icon to get notified every single time I drop a new podcast. I'm trying to drop these every Wednesday, you know, and I've been pretty consistent about it. So make sure you subscribe. Make sure you drop a like down below. That helps me out a ton. And make sure that you share this with everybody you know. Tell them, hey, you know, Tareeb, you remember him from school? You remember the kid from elementary school who couldn't write his N's the right way? Yeah, he has a podcast. He just kind of rambles for about 30 minutes. So go and watch that and make sure you do that. So thank you guys again for tuning in, and I hope you guys have a great rest of your day.